You're listening to Australia's national youth radio station, Triple J. For more info, go to triplej.net.au.
Hack on Triple J.
G'day, Kate O'Toole with you for Hack. Australians under 30 spent $40 billion last year on stuff they don't really need.
It's like a form of therapy, you know. If you feel sad, go and buy something, makes you feel better.
$40 billion, that's a whole lot of feeling better. We're going to talk about rampant consumerism today. But first, though, aftershocks of up to 6.2 on the Richter scale have been felt on the Solomon Islands after yesterday's tsunami. Around 4,000 islanders are up in the hills, too afraid to return to sea level. Groups like the Red Cross and Oxfam are coordinating disaster plans for the west coast of the island. One spot that bore the brunt of the tsunami is a tourist spot called Gizo. Danny Kennedy owns a dive shop there, and I spoke with him this afternoon.
I was physically being thrown 2 to 3 metres from side to side. Basically, everything in the house was broken. We're up on a hill, but there's a community right below us that we saw the wave come in and just clean that place out. And so I gave it about a half an hour, then I went down because I have a pet in the shop. And then I went down and just assessed our damage around our area. And, it was pretty devastating. It still really hasn't sunken in yet. We're just running on adrenaline at the moment, just trying to help people and people that are far more affected than we are.
And what does Gizo look like now? What are people doing?
Well, people are actually starting to clean up the town now a little bit, but obviously the southeast corner of it is pretty much just history. There's nothing left of it. It caught the brunt of the wave, but there's just a lot of water damage in town. And, I mean, you know, it's bad, but honestly, the people here are very, very resilient, and people are actually, you know, starting to filter back down into town. It's just that we're really still experiencing a lot of tremors. And even just as the phone rang, as I was walking to pick up the phone, the house shook quite dramatically again, and we had another really big one at 5 o'clock. So a lot of people are hanging up on the higher elevations because they're just scared to go back down into town.
So what are you able to do to help people?
Well, aside from just owning a dive shop, I'm actually the provincial member for Giza, so I'm their elected local member, and I've been appointed as part of an organizing committee to actually assist people and get the necessary equipment and items to people that are most needed. So we basically have been in meetings today trying to get food and water and shelter to people. As well as one of the things that we had a problem with was there's a lot of debris on the airfield, and we had engaged about 150 guys to go over with rakes and shovels and wheelbarrows and actually clear the airfield. And I'm told about an hour ago that the airfield is clear and ready to start letting flights land there, and that'll actually get the humanitarian assistance moving pretty quickly. But at the moment, we were pretty much just cut off completely from the outside world.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us today, Danny. What are your main priorities for the cleanup? Obviously, you've got extra responsibilities there. What are you going to be doing for the rest of today?
I will be going back down to the to our little crisis center and trying to find out what's happened and what hasn't happened. And I'll just take on board one or two of the areas of priority that haven't been dealt with. And it'll probably be using my vehicle and loading a bunch of water and food in it and trying to get it to a community and dropping it off and just basically driving and picking people up and moving personal belongings for the people that are going down the hill and just providing, vehicular assistance to people that need it.
That's Danny Kennedy. He's the owner of a dive shop in Gizo on the west coast of the Solomon Islands.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J with Kate O'Toole.
For years, big record companies have been battling illegal downloaders either in the courts or using technology like DRM. But today we're wondering if that battle could be over. That's because overnight in London, one of the world's big four record companies, EMI, announced that it was putting an end to DRM, Digital Rights Management. The company will make all its music available online with no copy protection. That means that you can share it and copy it as much as you like. So does this mean record companies have given up on trying to control downloaders? Brandon Sharkey has the story.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon.
For a significant announcement, as EMI was claiming on this occasion, it was done in a pretty plain venue.
Welcome to EMI's staff canteen. Doesn't always look like this. We've dressed it up a bit for this special occasion.
That's EMI boss Eric Nicolay in London, announcing that from May, all EMI songs will be available DRM-free on Apple's iTunes online store. The songs will also gradually be available through other online shops. Apple's boss Steve Jobs was there as well. He said he's expecting half of iTunes' catalogue to be DRM-free by the end of the year, which means other record companies signing up. But as far as Triple J listener Ben is concerned, it's not going to change his downloading habits at all, because he stopped downloading singles years ago.
You find there's actually seems to be record companies out there, or someone's out there putting up phantom or fake versions of songs as well. So you could go and download, you know, try and download five or six copies of the song, and, you know, you might find that none of them actually work. So now you're stuck with, like, BitTorrent-type clients where, yeah, the only real way of listening to one song is to download the entire album.
Ben's 24 and he reckons he downloads about an album a week without paying for it. But he says most of the 200 CDs in his collection were bought after downloading a song illegally.
If I was going to spend money purchasing music, I would go and buy the physical copy from a CD store. If I was going to download it, then I would just download it for free.
But people who've been watching the file-sharing industry for a while reckon the EMI announcement is a symbolic big deal. Alex Malik's a Sydney technology lawyer who's writing his PhD on copyright protection in the digital age.
It's a historic moment, but maybe not as historic as we'd like it to be. On the surface, it looks like it's fantastic news for those of us supporting a free and open internet, but there are lots of conditions involved.
So what are the scary conditions for you?
Scary conditions is firstly, it's tied in the US to a price rise of 30%. We don't know yet to what extent that's going to be happening in Australia. And, of course, if prices go up here by 30%, we're talking about potentially price of a CD single going up to $2.20 or $2.30.
But considering EMI's history of pushing copy protection, maybe this is a big turnaround. Here's a hack story from 2004 about the Perth hip-hop band Downside's problems with EMI.
Obviously, it meant we had this funny sticker on the front of the artwork, which we weren't expecting. We were in the first wave of artists that were released with that technology being used, so I thought it was a lack of courtesy more than anything that we would have been nice to know.
That's Downside's manager, Paul Sloan. Hack called EMI Australia a couple of times today, and late this afternoon they did agree to an interview, but not till tomorrow. So until then, we're left with the online recording of EMI's boss in London, Eric Nicolay.
As a shining example, and to get the ball rolling, the brand new single from the Good, the Bad and the Queen album, along with the album, will be available from today on the band's website in high-quality MP3 format. The MP3 files, purchased from thegoodthebadandthequeen.com, can be used on any digital music device, including music-enabled mobile phones.
So with EMI dropping its copy protection and kicking off by releasing those songs on Apple's iTunes, next question is, will Apple do the same for the iPod? At the moment, when you buy a song on iTunes, unless you're good with techie details, it's a bit of an effort to play the song on anything other than an iPod. When Hack called Apple Australia, we got the usual response. No to an interview, and no, they don't know if the deal means you'll be able to buy an EMI track on iTunes and listen to it on something besides an iPod. Sydney technology lawyer Alex Malik is not convinced that you'll have that freedom.
Invariably, when it comes to exciting new press releases, which celebrate something new in the marketplace, there are usually conditions and little fine lines available.
Alex, what about Apple's position on DRM? Apple boss Steve Jobs wrote an essay that was up on his website a couple of months ago, and in it he says that he doesn't want to reveal info about Apple's Fair Play DRM because that would allow songs to be played on unauthorized players. What does that mean to you?
It sounds to me like I could tell you what we're doing, but if I tell you, I'd have to kill you.
So, Alex, do you think Steve Jobs is contradicting himself in that on the one hand he's saying, hey, let's get rid of DRM and they've signed this deal with EMI, but on the other hand, he's not willing to hand over the details on Apple's own DRM?
I think it's not just a matter of contradiction, but there's also a matter that he's so determined not to reveal it, he'd rather take it out and not use it than reveal it.
The EMI deal also means that songs will be available for download in a higher quality. But you guessed it, there is a catch coming. You'll have to pay extra for the privilege. In the US on iTunes, that means an extra 30 cents. So will it also cost more in Australia? Of course, Apple Australia's reluctant spokesman didn't know the answer to that or wouldn't say. So it's back to someone who will talk to us, Sydney lawyer Alex Malik.
Maybe they've been sending out lower quality MP3s as a means of actually preventing piracy. I mean, maybe that's literally been yet another method. If you let them have it at a lower quality, they're less likely to duplicate it and put it on the internet.
As for Triple J listener Ben, he reckons big record companies like EMI should have abandoned copy protection years ago.
I've never been stopped by anything like any time that I've ever wanted to download an album, it's been available.
That's Triple J listener Ben, who does a bit of illegal downloading, talking about EMI's plans to release all its music online with no copy protection. And as we mentioned there, EMI Australia has agreed to chat to us tomorrow, so stay tuned for their response.
Hack on Triple J.
Like it or dislike it, we're stuck with it now.
Charities and hospitals that receive donations from bikie gangs give outlaw clubs a veneer of respectability. That's what the Queensland Police Minister, Judy Spence, reckons. Yesterday, she slagged off cash-strapped hospitals and charities for taking money from bikie fundraisers. Well, what about our own party? Where do they get their cash from? Caitlin Sorey looked into it for Hack.
Toy donations by bikie gang members are nothing more than a shameless marketing exercise to disguise their criminality. I know in the past that hospitals and charities have accepted donations from outlaw motorcycle gangs, but it's time they stopped giving these criminals a veneer of respectability by accepting their gifts.
That's what the Queensland Police Minister, Judy Spence, was quoted as saying yesterday. And it got us thinking here at Hack, what about the money the Queensland Labor Party accepts as political donations? Are their donors squeaky clean? Like, for instance, Australian mining giant Santos, which you may remember for this incident which began last May.
As far as the eye can see, there is bubbling mud right up to rooftop gutters, and tips of street lights look awkwardly bent short above the surface of the dark, toxic brew.
Indonesia's president has ordered more than $500 million to be paid to correct damage wrought by the mud volcano, which has displaced 13,000 people in East Java. The major Australian gas and oil company Santos has an 18% stake in the exploration.
Rebecca Henschke is a journalist working in Indonesia.
It's still going to this day. Just yesterday, it's been reported that the mud has moved into more villages and it's swamping a railway track. The suffering of the people there is extraordinary. They haven't received compensation and they're still waiting while watching their homes swamped in this mud.
The Queensland Labor Government, according to the latest records, received three political donations from Santos in 2006, totalling a little over $6,000. The records for political donations are only reported once a year, so it's impossible to know if there's been any more recently. Brad Peterson is the president of Democracy Watch, a group set up to lobby for political funding reform. Would you consider Judy Spence's remarks about bikie gangs and then her own party receiving money from Santos as being a double standard?
I think it's more than double standard. You're being too polite. I think it's a really gross hypocrisy. The Queensland Labor Party, like the Queensland Liberal Party, both collect hundreds of thousands of dollars from some of Australia's largest corporations, greenhouse belching polluters, publicans, developers, you name it. They're collecting money left, right and centre.
And what's your issue with that?
Well, I think she's really trying to take the moral high ground that she doesn't deserve to be part of.
I just think it's ludicrous. Whether it's bikie gangs or anybody else, frankly, for political parties to be lecturing other people on who they should and shouldn't take donations from is just the cheek of it is breathtaking.
Andrew Bartlett is a senator from Queensland for the Democrats. In your opinion, should any party be taking donations from Santos?
Well, I think we need to have a lot more transparent approach in regard to political donations, and that includes more awareness of what corporations are involved in. Unfortunately, in the last couple of years, the changes to the Electoral Act have made much less transparency in regard to donations, so in future it'll be easier for parties to get donations from companies, whether it's Santos or anybody else, without anybody even knowing.
Senator Bartlett says the electoral changes means that a company can donate close to $90,000 without the party having to disclose it if it's strategically spread between state and federal branches. So anyone, including bikies, can make political donations without the party declaring it. But what's so bad about bikies donating money anyway, whether it's to a political party or a hospital? Well, Minister Spence said yesterday that there was no question of the criminal nature of bikie gangs.
It's particularly shocking to me, as arguably Australia's most accomplished researcher in the area, to see that the police minister is unaware of her own organization's report, Operation Crystal, which defined the motorcycle clubs as non-criminal entities. Some members of the clubs were involved in crime, but they were not crime entities themselves.
Arthur Vino is a research associate at Monash University. His book, The Brotherhood, is used as a textbook on outlaw motorcycle gangs.
The clubs are comprised of individuals who relate well to abusive situations, in that so many of them have abusive pasts and suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder for a number of reasons. They pride themselves on the generosity of the actions of charity.
But is it fair to accept, though, that there are people who are involved in these charity organisations who are indulging in criminal behaviour? Is it fair enough that the police minister should come out with a statement like this?
The clubs themselves do have criminals in them, there's no doubt about it. But let's be clear about it. This is a moral panic campaign. This is not anything to do with the rights or wrongs of helping those less fortunate in our communities, which is what it should be about.
That's the author of Brotherhood, Arthur Vino, speaking there with Caitlin Sorey. And we did try to get an interview with the Queensland Police Minister, Judy Spence, but she wasn't available for an interview Friday, yesterday or today.
This is Hack.
Latch on to any cause that it possibly can.
On Triple J.
If you've ever felt the urge to buy something frivolous, something that you don't really need, well, you're not alone. A new report by a youth marketing firm says that last year, young Aussies spent over $40 billion on clothes, travel and entertainment. And while some might say that this kind of spending shows that we live in an abundant, fun society, others reckon it's a sign of rampant consumerism and that we might all be getting a little bit too shallow, materialistic and apathetic for our good. Luke Williams delves into the debate for Hack.
Young adults, we're talking 16 to 30-year-olds, spend upwards of $40 billion per annum on their hedonistic pursuits. So their sport, their music, their fashion, their entertainment and their travel, basically. Oh, damn,
the club. If I wore a dress that I'd already worn to a party, people would think I can't afford other clothes.
The French philosopher Blaise Pascal said that at the base of the human heart is a God-shaped hole that longs to be filled.
It's like a form of therapy, you know. If you feel sad, go and buy something, makes you feel better.
So let me at this point invite you to Melbourne's very chic Chapel Street. Here you'll see lots of cashed-up youngsters stuffing their God-shaped holes with designer jeans, designer haircuts and iPod speakers.
Okay, today I went to Sports Girl with a voucher and I bought a blue belt and a white cardigan top for a party.
I've bought my Logitech iPod speakers. Just crank it out.
What's the thrill of buying stuff that you don't really need?
Makes me feel whole.
It makes you feel whole?
Well, just good, I don't know. Happy.
Well, if that is true, then there must be a lot of happiness going around at the moment. Lucy Moore is analyst with youth marketing company Life Lounge. Their new market research report shows that youth spending is on the way up.
I guess there's sort of three key areas that are the top of the money. The big one is their entertainment, again, so their Saturday night entertainment, going out with their mates, hanging out, that kind of thing. Also right up there is their fashion spends and also their travel spends. Females are spending on average $289 on clothes, fashion, accessories every 4 weeks. Males, $229. On top of that, they spend on average $68 a week or $68 every Saturday night going out, getting pissed, hanging out with their friends. And then a further $49 every 4 weeks on recorded music, so CDs or digital downloads, whatever they can get their hands on.
Yes, some real dollar dazzlers there, and exactly the kind of thing that has led social commentator James Norman to describe the youth of today as shallow, politically disengaged and materialistic.
Certainly the decade under a government such as Howard has exacerbated that, just to the sense of, the message that we're giving is that, you know, our lives can to some extent be measured, but our worth can be measured by, you know, our wealth, our social status, all those things which I think are ultimately just going to actually not give people a real sense of meaning in their lives.
See you, man.
He bought undies for...
I bought undies.
Because they were brand.
$36 for a pair of underwear.
What's the idea behind getting $36 undies?
They're hot. They're sexy.
I got money for it.
Someone just say who gives a shit.
Yeah. Is that you? Why do you say that?
Does it matter?
Do you think that people putting a lot of time and energy into buying stuff that they don't really need is something worth questioning?
It's up to them. It's their choice.
If you're spending your whole life trying to earn money for stuff you don't really need, then doesn't that make sense that that's a bit of a waste, a bit meaningless?
If they want it, they want it. It's their choice.
You might as well live your life, though. Like, why hold back if you want something?
I think that young adults can be materialistic, but I don't think it's materialism that is driving them. It's not this need for consumer goods, this need to have everything and all those kind of things. It's not that that's driving them. I think it's this idea of urban capital. It's experiences. It's, you know, status amongst peers kind of concept that's driving young adults to entertain themselves, really.
Because I guess that's what a lot of young people say. They say, we know we buy stuff that we don't really need, but we don't really see the harm. And in fact, some people might look at that and think, well, it's a sign that we're living in a very abundant, leisure-driven society, and what's wrong with that?
People really looking for instant gratification, you know, whether that's from a new T-shirt or, you know, some other new item of clothing or some other consumer good that we don't really need. But I think that ultimately that's not going to give people meaning in their lives. I think that, you know, we need to really start looking at more nourishing sources of personal fulfilment rather than what consumerism can offer.
And yet we hear again and again from the kids that it makes them feel good. It lifts their mood. One girl actually said it fills a hole.
Mm. Well, that's the great market con, isn't it? You know, I'd like to just encourage people to think beyond that, you know, and to question, you know, question the messages that we're sent in advertising and to look for their own sources of fulfilment, you know. I think further down the road, that's going to be much more nourishing than, you know, just buying the latest Calvin Klein, you know, underwear or whatever it is.
Yeah, our money could go to so many, like, better things, like, or we could donate it, give it to charity or something, but instead we just buy things for ourselves we don't need, we end up throwing them out. And there's all these people where they'd give, like, anything just to have a bit of clothing on their back. So, yeah, we're pretty greedy and selfish. That's just how Australia is, I guess.
Luke Williams reporting there.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J with Kate O'Toole.
Blogs are supposed to be a kind of online democracy, but that's not the case for high-profile US blogger Kathy Sierra. Last week she went public about some serious abuse she was copping from anonymous bloggers on her site. She's received death threats too, and one blogger has photoshopped some sexually explicit photos of her online. Kathy ended up cancelling speaking engagements because the threats freaked her out so much. Many bloggers are now calling for a code of ethics on blogging. Bill Birtles has more.
I feel horrible. I feel frightened. I'm ready to just quit the whole industry.
That's Kathy Sierra. She's a prominent US blogger who recently went public about abuse and violent threats that were being posted on her blog. Amongst the abuse was a picture of her head in a noose and a comment about slitting her throat. There was also a lot of sexual comments. So why is it that some people say things through a computer screen that they'd never say in real life?
I think one of the things that this has sort of shown up in a big way is that there's a lot of stuff that we don't want to talk about in the modern PC culture that is just bubbling under the surface. And once we've given it an outlet, which is the blog, so you can be anonymous as you want, all of a sudden all this stuff that we sort of thought we'd put behind us as modern 21st century people, which is in particular an enormous wealth of racism and misogyny, has just bubbled up, and it's forcing us all to take a look at it because it's available to all of us.
That's Mark Pesci, a technology consultant and a blogger who's done his fair share of moderating comments. Hack got him and two other bloggers together, Jeff War, who develops software for online communities, and Mary Gardner, who heads up the Linux Chicks, a group of female bloggers who blog about software.
I'm mainly involved with online communities which have a pretty high female participation, and we tend to find that we get quite a lot of misogynist material. Not always to the extreme that people directed at Kathy Sierra, but a sort of a lot of low-level stuff like insinuations that by being technical we must also be ugly and sexless, or we must also be incredibly beautiful and wanting to date technical men and that sort of thing, and also occasionally right through to outright misogynist, violent kind of threats.
Why is it, do you think, that when people are under the cloak of anonymity, they behave in ways or they treat humans in ways which they certainly wouldn't do if they actually had to put their name and face to it?
I mean, well, the first thing is that anonymity gives you a lack of consequence. You won't be punished for your actions if you could proceed safely and anonymously.
One of the projects that I work on is a blog aggregator called Planet, and it brings all blog entries from a community together onto one page. And quite early on, we put these little floating pictures of the people's heads alongside their blog entries to give you that sense of, you know, here is a person, here is their face, they're a real human being. And that's brought a kind of civility that we hadn't seen before, because if it's a mailing list or if it's a internet chat or anything like that, it's just text on a page. You don't see a person.
Is there some sort of consequence if you do behave badly online? I mean, you block people from mailing lists, and of course moderators block people from groups. What sort of consequences are there, if any?
In really extreme circumstances, in fact, I think Kathy Sierra did this, people have been known to involve the police, but then you run into the problem of it being an international sphere. You don't know, until you do your research, you don't know whether the person who has been terrible to you is subject to the same laws that you are, or if they're, say, if they're in another country, how you can possibly get the police involved, whether... whether you're able to exercise any power of the law. So generally, you don't have recourse to that kind of thing where you might have recourse to the law in a face-to-face harassment situation.
So stepping outside of the blogosphere and more generally into online communities, do you see an extension of this sort of abuse in things like virtual worlds? And do you think, because in virtual worlds you're not just a name and words on a page, does that make any difference?
This kind of stuff not only goes on in virtual worlds, but it can be potentially more distressing to people because they identify really strongly with their persona in the online world. So the more strongly you identify with your persona, the more you feel the violation, to the point where a description of a rape feels like you've been raped.
Some people have come out in the wake of this and they've said there needs to be a code of conduct for blogging on the internet. What do you guys think about this idea?
Blogging is just, so many people are doing it across so many different communities that you can't institute a code of conduct for blogging in general. But if you start your blog with a code of conduct, or if you start an online community and you have the rules of engagement and they're very clear and you're clear about your leadership, then that could be a huge boon for your community.
So we've talked about some of the bad effects that anonymity can have, but what about some of the good aspects of being anonymous online?
Well, I mean, there's transparency. There's the ability to blow a whistle, to expose something without fear of retribution for opening your mouth. And, you know, as cultures become more and more afraid and more closed down because of terrorism or whatever the shibboleth of the moment is, the more we need that space to be completely anonymous.
Yeah, it really needs to be considered more on a case-by-case basis. If you're badly behaving, whether you're anonymous or not, you should be excluded from a community or reprimanded. If you're a well-behaving person using a pseudonym or using anonymity, then it's good for you to be able to contribute to communities without using your name.
That's Mary Gardner from the Linux Chicks group. Mark Pesci was there as well. He's a tech consultant. And Jeff Waugh, a software developer. They're all bloggers, and they were speaking there to Bill Birtles.
This is Hack.
Latch on to any cause that it possibly can.
On Triple J.
David Hicks's Australian lawyer, David McLeod, says that Hicks will have to face US interrogators one last time before he leaves Guantanamo Bay.
He's simply been asked to cooperate, so he's proposing to do so.
Okay, and do they take the same format as they have done in the past?
Well, hopefully without the torture this time.
Now, we know that as part of Hicks's plea bargain, he can't talk to the media at all for 12 months, and he's agreed that nothing illegal happened to him during his detention. So what's that comment about from his lawyer? Exactly how far does this gag agreement reach? Even David's dad, Terry Hicks, is unsure about what he can and can't say. In the meantime, he's not saying much.
The gag doesn't gag me from saying what I think. The gag gags me from saying what David tells me.
So can you talk to me about anything that David has told you, either about his conditions in Guantanamo Bay or otherwise?
No.
Not at all?
No. If I tell him, I'll probably get him 7 years. That's the penalty. If he breaks that agreement, then he copped 7 years.
That's Terry Hicks, Guantanamo Bay detainee, David Hicks's dad. And that's Hack for today. If you've missed anything in the last week and you'd like to hear it, hit the Hack website, triplej.net.au/hack, and download the podcast. Or if you've got a story you'd love us to follow up, leave your details and we'll get back to you. Rosie Beaton is up next with Super Request. I'll catch you tomorrow at 5:30.
Triple J.